Welcome to the Confusion Matrix, where we have lively and candid discussions about data, data science and AI in day-to-day life, business and beyond. I'm Alex Lovelace.
I'm Pete Hodge.
Okay, so what are we going to talk about today? So I've got something. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
I was just digging around in the latest Data Elixir newsletter. I'm sure you get to. It's very good newsletter for anyone in the data science community. There's an article in there on flat files where they're talking about what a flat file is and what qualifies as a flat file and the blurry edges of that definition. And in itself, it's quite an interesting article. I guess it's not gonna change the world, but it gave me a bit of a warm, fuzzy feeling about flat files, because I really like flat files. And it sounds almost blasphemous to say that, because, you know, we have databases, we've got, you know, decades behind us of relational databases and their ilk. We've gone through the NoSQL revolution, document stores, you know, key value stores, graph databases, vector stores. There's a database for every bloody use case to account for any particular thing that you want to do. And I guess you could call flat files in themselves a database, but I just like them because they're so simple and easy. And there's none of this other stuff in the way, like SQL and having to construct weird queries using either code or JSON and things like that. And also, anytime someone gives me a normalized relational database, I'll flatten it. It goes into a data frame, and then if I think, oh, I've got to use that again, I'm going to dump it down onto disk into maybe something like Parquet or a Python pickle or something, but more often than not, then I'll save it out as CSV, simply because then I can read it if I need to. And so I really like flat files. Mm. And I think they're really underrated. And I think, Pete, prior contract stroke clients that we've had where due to certain technological conditions, flat files were pretty much necessitated for almost everything. Mm-hmm. And we got very used to just dealing with them on a day-to-day basis and just comfortable with it. And so now I think, you know, whenever I turn up and someone says, oh, you've got this, we've got this amazing data warehouse with a star schema normalized to the nth degree, and it's all so amazing. And I just, my soul dies a little. My heart sinks, knowing that I'm going to have to get into a world of painful, depressing, boring SQL and understanding this ultimately normalized data structure, which just slows everything down. And in our discipline, we care less about reducing redundancy and managing master data to the nth degree. We just want we want to do some analysis, and this is just detritus that gets in the way. So what's your thought on flat files?
Yeah, well, no, I was going to say exactly the same. That, you know, the reason you have databases and everything, you know, there are good reasons, and it's really around, for me in my head, it's around the processing of the data, and that data is there because you're running a process and you want to shape the data so that your process is as efficient as possible. And then you've got sort of other constraints in there, you know, collecting millions of rows, and so you can't just throw it in. And so there are lots of different problems that databases address, you know. And you know, the great thing is that it gives you a sort of a fairly universally known structure, if you want to call it that, or several different structures. And so no matter what your data is, what your company, what your process is, you can use this, you know, one of several fairly generic solutions, and that therefore the skills for that are easy to come by, etc. And I think you know, you're never going to move away from that, and it makes sense. And there's always going to be constraints other than what you're doing. So putting it in a database and creating it and getting that first layer of, here's something the business does, to, okay, well, now we're able to facilitate that and record that data and the inputs and the outputs. And then we come along and say, okay, well, now we you know, we're not part of that process. We're looking to measure that process. We want to look into that process. We want to look at inefficiencies. We want to look at patterns that are now coming out of that. And so we're just sort of interested in the data, and we kind of want to get it out. And because the data science world has been born, you know, in the last kind of 15 years, then it's kind of been born into, well, size doesn't matter that much. And yeah, had the whole sort of big data wave. And part of that was about, well, 30 years ago, you did have to worry about how you stored this stuff because you might run out of disk storage. But when you're born into, you know, a world where disk and processing power is where it is even 15 years ago, and then still doubling and chips getting smaller and stuff going into the cloud, suddenly worrying about how the stuff is stored so I can access it, you know, and I was going to say data science was born into a world where that matters a lot less. And so we get hold of data, like you say, we load it into a data frame, which is effectively, you know, flat file in memory, you know, it's like a, you know, a tabular format. And we just say, well, can I load in a million rows? And it says, yeah, that's fine. You know, so we go, well, we don't need to stretch it out into 17 different tables and have deduplication. And yeah, we load in a load of duplicate data. We write a couple of sort of queries, and the tools we use deal with that. And you just go, okay, well, give me the unique value there. Right. And you say, well, how do I get that? I do something like column.unique. I've got all the unique values. It took me, you know, 15 seconds and 5 seconds processing power. I don't need to do any more. So all of that kind of worry goes out the window, and you want to get to the data that you want to process, kind of load it all in, and then start looking at the problem. Anything else, like you say, is just secondary. Why am I worrying about whether a column has repeated values? I mean, I just don't care. It's just, I'm glad somebody cares. But with what I'm doing right now, I just don't care. I've got the tools to navigate it.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, what I'm not saying is that A, structured data is a bad thing, or B, there are no problems with flat files or equivalent formats. I'm just simply saying, you know, that this all this other stuff just gets in the way. And I always want to feel like I'm as close as possible to the raw data. And if you're talking about things like the master data records of customer records, then that's almost certainly good enough. But if you're talking about like raw behavior data, like hits to a website or touch points of a person through a physical space or anything like that, that's sort of temporal, then the relational structures tend to be quite subtractive. I think often stuff is lost in the mix when relational data architects, the zealots that they are, get in there and start tinkering with things and decide what we do and don't need. And for the sake of paucity or saving disk space or simplicity of structure, start throwing things away, which is travesty in my world.
Yeah.
And it you know, it fills me with dread and horror. And the other thing is, people put things in databases correctly, especially things like master data or data that cannot be volatile and that needs to be secure. For example, customer records. And a lot of the time, I don't want that stuff anywhere near me, right? Especially if I'm providing services. Yeah. I don't want to see any email address, phone, God no. Just take that stuff away from me. So you've got some tables in there that are like, you know, appointment bookings for customers or in for a like a medical facility or something, and they want to understand, you know, return visits or whatever, something like that. Yes, of course, I really want to analyze that. Give me an obfuscated customer ID and then, you know, as anonymized everything else as you can, right? Don't, for God's sake, give me any names or anything like that. And so I don't want access. Go here, have access to my database. And I'm like, no, go away. Do not do that, right? I don't want it. I don't need it. Just give me the bits that I need. And then I don't have to worry. It makes everything so much cleaner and easier. And again, I'm not saying there's no issues with that, but I don't need all that other stuff. And at which point, once you've siphoned it down to those bits and pieces, often, you know, a flat file or a Parquet file, something like that is the best place for it. Now, you know, we get into the world of CSVs, which is a very sordid corner of the data space. But I've got a soft spot for CSVs, even though, you know, you can't meaningfully query them without loading the whole thing into memory. And there are all sorts of encoding and formatting issues, which is why we have JSON and XML. But there's just something beautifully simplistic, almost elemental about our trade. You know, you might say the stock of, you know, the most elemental thing in our trade is like Excel, an Excel file or something, or maybe a something akin to an Access database or something. But it's not. It's the CSV. It's the good old CSV for me, potentially TSV or fixed width. But I mean, who's mad enough to use fixed width?
Yeah.
And I think there's something there about that you're... you know, you love your modern hip hop, but you got a real soft spot for Afrika Bambaataa and the Sugar Hill Gang. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's all a bit analog, but we still dig that shit, right? And that's for me. That's why I think it gave me the warm and fuzzies. It's somewhat practical and somewhat nostalgic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, if you were go back 30, 40 years, being, you know, people probably talking about the death of flat files, you know.
Oh, it's like the death of email, right?
Yeah.
We still have email. In fact, email seems to have got more pervasive. So I now have email and I have Messenger and I have SMS and I have whatever else we've got.
Video. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And bloody X and TikTok and everything like that. But so we now have relational databases, all these other types of database and flat files and CSVs and Parquets and all the sort of equivalents in that realm and all the Hadoop stuff. And I think we're better off for it, if I'm honest, even if the landscape is a little bit more complicated. But ultimately, what happens when you've got some trouble with an Excel file, right? You dump it out to UTF-8 CSV, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like go and see what's wrong with it. And there's some bollocks encoding error in there or something. So we need them. They are our lifeblood.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's an important point there is especially for the sort of game we're in, flat files just give you that speed and simplicity. And, you know, we're not saying that you would design some, you know, customer-facing essential system with flat files in the back, but for the sort of stuff we're doing, where there's a lot of experimental, and we could well come up with a solution to something which lasts a week because it's superseded by something else we discover, or it turns out not to be suitable. You know, why would you want to design that out? You want the minimum design possible because your design sort of comes secondary, because we're saying, well, look, we seem to have this answer. If we provide this data in this manner, is that going to be useful to the business? And they look at it and go, no, I'm going to need this, this, and this. And you go, okay, great. Let me model that. If you're designing, doing a whole load of design work in there to get it right, and someone poo-poos it like that, then that's just time gone. But if you're just dumping it out to a file, you've got some tools to get the data you need, you whack it up and someone says, I like that. Yeah, sure, then you've got a problem because you're going, right, well, this isn't scalable in its current form, but that's a secondary problem to, well, do I even want it? You know, there's no point in designing it out, getting it perfect. Someone says, no, it's useless to me. So, you know, that speed is really useful. And yeah, sure, you pay for it, but if you're going through five or six different solutions, then I think it's, you know, and you have flat files in those solutions because it gets you those solutions quick, then I think it more than pays for itself. Yeah, and then you settle on something and then you say, right, well, we need to design the, you know, the data structure of this properly. And then, yeah, sure, maybe your databases start coming in, maybe not. But
I would take some issue with at least part of that, which is that, for example, if you look at the modern web CMS, you know, these bits of software that run websites,
yeah,
there's quite a lot of these headless CMSs and sort of ultra lightweight CMSs that are essentially flat. Everything is in flat files, and there's just code that translates that from one form to another.
Yeah,
and they're super lightweight and they're super fast. Now, I'm not saying the same thing is true for the sort of data and analysis space, because presumably data is updating, and if it gets too big, the CSVs are not anywhere near the fastest. But at much smaller levels, for sort of very enclosed, slowly changing applications, and in the spirit of keeping them small, I really do think that that's a good idea. And also, when you take into account things like SQLite and various other in-memory or in-application embedded databases, we've not really moved that far away from flat files with some of these.
Yeah,
I mean, many of them will offer full, you know, relational access, but under the hood, there's not a lot going on, right? They're just optimized code on top of data, right?
Yeah.
Stored in text, and so I sort of think that we're not in such a different realm there. And any applications that are out there running with one of these embedded databases in the mix is closer to the spirit we're talking about than a data warehouse, star schema, master data management, slowly changing dimensions behemoth in the middle of a giant corporation.
Agreed, yeah.
Right. That's probably enough on flat files. I'm sure we'll mention them again many times. What have you got?
The thing I was going to bring up was around generative AI. Boo. But it was from a podcast that we both listened to called Practical AI. A couple of guys that run that, very good. You know, they're always, as we are, focused on the practical sides and how these things fit into business, and, you know, some of the practical steps to building, and what these different models mean, and how can you actually make it work for you. So it's a good one to listen to.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It, in fact, it's the only AI dedicated podcast that I regularly listen to. Some of these AI podcasts are just bloody industry shills that are just trumpeting the next OpenAI nonsense, as if we've jumped 10 years into the future for every release and how amazing this is, and you go look at it and it doesn't work 90% of the time.
Yeah.
These guys, I think, they pitch it at the right level for business users, right back to practitioners like us. They come from very, very reputable companies. One of them's Lockheed Martin, the other one is Prediction Guard, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And so these guys are deeply embedded in really, really serious, very, very, what's the word, mature use cases. And I generally find they take a very sober, very down-to-earth view on Gen AI when everyone else is being either shrill in the sense that it's, you know, Gen AI, everything is amazing, we're all going to be rich, to, you know, the Ed Zitrons of this world, who are like, this is all crap, why are we bothering, why are you wasting the money and the carbon? So, yeah, I just wanted to reinforce that recommendation. But yeah. Back over to you.
Yeah, no, and it's great. And also they look at the full breadth of AI, you know, which includes, you know, if you're into it, you know, machine learning and...
Machine learning. Wash your mouth out with soap. Who needs machine learning? Who needs machine learning when you can just get an LLM to do everything you want for you? Easy peasy, job done.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but I do. They're putting up quite a front on that, and it's quite pleasing that they keep coming back to it as being still the bedrock of what we do.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, saying all these things together. And so they interviewed, they had a guy on who was a CEO of a startup who created a product called Chip, CHIPP.AI is their website. And basically it's a front end skin, if you want to call it that, onto generative AI chatbots, I suppose, if you want to call them that. But essentially what it allows you to do is with no code, go in and create your own assistant, I think is probably what you'd call it. So what you're doing is you probably giving it, I've not fully gone the hands on it yet, but effectively it's you're giving it system prompts. So you're probably saying, okay, well, you're my assistant. I work in marketing, I do this, that, and the other, and I expect you to do this. And one of the things they encourage you to do is to run through what your job is, you know, just say what it is and say, oh, you're an assistant, here's my job, here's what I do, and I want you to help me out. And then, you know, you could start using it and start asking it questions, and you know, and it must have some bits behind the scenes to, you know, record and put that into its own database so it knows who you are. They've put a skin over the top of all this. It's sort of stuff that we do, and we do it sort of behind the scenes, and they put skin over it so you don't have to worry about any code. So the starting point of saying, okay, but I don't know how to create a chatbot, to create my own assistant and then interacting with it, thing is like less than half an hour with no code and using, you know, some fairly straightforward tools via a quite nice looking GUI. And you know, we've spoken a few times about how we're using some of this stuff, and if we talk to people, they're going to go, what on earth are you talking about? And it just struck me that this is what they've created is great, and a good way into a general worker, if you want to call it that, actually starting to create an AI and going, oh, right, now I get what you're talking about. You know, because we have layers of deal with some of the APIs and the tools behind it and some of the code, you know, sometimes we've sort of said, yeah, but how's your average Joe going to start here? And I think this is a great tool for your average Joe to start.
Well, this is goes to the heart of, I think, why the Gen AI, particularly the LLM industry, is in a bit of a state at the moment, not least because of the DeepSeek and things like that. But there's a pronounced and well-known lack of adoption among, you know, the normies, the average rando on the street, and this tool is set up specifically to try and bridge that gap. And I think we've discussed between us many times before that, and this is what they said in that podcast, essentially, if you go to ChatGPT, you're just given a box that says, you know, ask me some shit, right? And that's great for sort of ambient Google-like things, which will almost certainly, if the responses are accurate, improve your productivity a little bit. But if you're sitting there, you know, in front of a spreadsheet or on your CRM system looking for leads, or you know, any day-to-day sort of job, the jump between a Google-like box to an agent, or at least a helper, a sort of personalized chatbot or a mini me, I just don't think normal people can. I say normal people. I'm not saying we're not normal, but I don't think we are. Certainly not in this realm, anyway. So your average Joe is not going to be able to make those jumps. And I think a lot of techies who made that jump quite naturally, having come via routes of automation, for anyone who's been developing for any period of time knows that, you know, don't do anything twice, right? Mm-hmm. And so that mentality is easy for us. And I just don't think that many other people see that. And so what you see is a Gen AI bubbling up through things like sort of mini dedicated agents within, like, for example, Office 365. The thing I use for editing Descript, I've got Warp Terminal, and they've got all these little agent-like things that are in context, in line imposing themselves on bits of your day-to-day job that when they work well are really helpful. But it's almost like the facial recognition on Facebook is that just turned up and it didn't revolutionize anything. It might have freaked a whole bunch of people out, but it gets used and it's machine learning, it's AI that's there, but it's just ambient, and that's what people need. But as the point gets made over and over, is that the people who can adopt Gen AI now to improve their productivity are going to be leaving their compatriots, their colleagues behind who haven't or can't do that. And I think the products like this that try and bridge that gap between the text box and the agent, but still allowing people the flexibility to find what they want that's suitable for their job, I think that's really important. But whether this particular bunch have got there yet is an open question.
Yeah, I think what was really interesting for me, and they mentioned it on the podcast, was, you know, they were like, how important the community's been for them in terms of growing their tool usage in their company. Because I think what you're saying there is there's a lot of AI in current tools at the moment. So if you're using Microsoft Word or something, then it might come and be an assistant on the side. If you're using Google Suite, same sort of thing. You know, you can have a document open, window on the side. But how much of that do you use your job? Something, a tool like this is kind of coming out of the tool. So it's saying, well, I'm not helping you with a tool that you use to use your job, do your job. And you have many tools, so I can only help you with one bit. This is like, I'll create your assistant based on everything you do, and therefore it could help you with everything. Now, I don't think it does it yet, but then you can imagine you've got this tool. You still got to go and ask it questions, but imagine if that was now just sitting there and listening to everything you did, doing, typing, phone calls, everything, and just kind of making suggestions. And I can see that as being somewhere where this stuff is going. Well, definitely some privacy issues there, but it would be useful because it's in on everything. And also it's not just on a certain tool. And I think this is probably going to be the transition that would really make a difference. Well, I mean, whether we'll ever get there, I don't know. But a tool like this where you are, you know, it's separate to any tool that you use, and for it to be helping you with all aspects of your job. And this also plays into the other element that we've discussed before, which is these things are not going to be in the form they're in at the moment and the foreseeable future. They're not going to be experts in the really good stuff that you do. They're going to be really good help in something you don't do that often, and some edge cases, and, you know, perhaps you create a slideshow once a month or you have to do a report. They're going to be great at helping you with that sort of stuff, doing some brainstorming and coming up with that new suggestion or getting to think about something a different way. Great for all that sort of thing. And these are generally small, almost one-offy type things, pretty, you know, one-offs that happen several times a day. But they're not like, oh, all I do all day is sit and brainstorm. It's like, no, I'll probably do that for about 20 minutes. So this thing's going to be really helpful for that 20 minutes. Well, when do you do that 20 minutes? Well, it's a bit random. And so if you've got something that's sitting there and listening and helping you, then every time you go to do it in that random time in your job over that random month, it's there to help you. Which, of course, if you have to go and use a tool, using a brainstorming tool or this sort of thing, you know, it's going to miss a few of those. We use many tools for our jobs on a daily basis, and then ultimately at some point we'll interact with those tools, you know. So you go, oh god, yeah, I'll tell you what, I've got planned for the team. I could just do with knocking it up in a spreadsheet, and then you say the names and the month you're on, and you spend 2 minutes telling it who's doing what, and then it gives you, you know, a Gantt chart. You probably just saved yourself 30, 40 minutes, maybe an hour, maybe 2 hours, just like that. But you're probably not doing that every day, but that would be really useful. And then you go, oh, okay, that's great. Can you email that to everyone? And bang, it's done. I mean, that, you know, that's the sort of panacea. And I think a tool like this is getting us closer to that step. And again, just comes back to, well, I've not lost my job because of that. Just meant that a whole bunch of things which were slightly pernickety and fiddly to get done have just become a whole lot easier. Might have just saved myself sort of half an hour in the day.
Yeah, and so either spend that on like scrolling through Blue Sky or do some more work, or perhaps take a longer lunch. But I think that we've come via so at one point having that sort of, and this is again something that was commented on that podcast, the single search box and effectively one button paradigm of Google. At the beginning, for people, that was very daunting, and now it's second nature. But we have sort of the inverse problem here now, in that people are presenting with a search box and knowing full well that there's a sort of a chat bot of sorts behind that. Really, the paradigm they're subconsciously working with is search with refinements, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about William Shakespeare. Here's William Shakespeare, blah, blah, William Shakespeare, blah, blah. He wrote these plays. Oh, right. Yeah, that's the play I was looking for. Tell me about more about Taming of the Shrew. Right. And tell me about this character, right?
Yeah.
Which is a really, really great use case to a degree, given hallucinations, although for pretty well-worn information now, that's pretty much largely solved. But that's not really what we're talking about here. We are talking about go and do stuff for me. You know, tell me how to do this quicker, better, and so on. And any number of use cases here we can list off and take hours doing so, all of which it'll either be good at or okay at, and will be time saving and labor saving that people just aren't thinking about. And so I think by putting, the job is still to be done to put one or more interfaces in front of people that gets them, shakes them out of the Google paradigm, and gets them and gives them opportunities to think about things in different ways. And I guess it's sort of a bit more akin to when you fire up one of the Office 365 apps and you've got different templates, right? Oh, yeah. Here's for Excel, you've got an accounting one and whatever, and or different PowerPoint templates. And I'm not saying it's a particularly good analogy. My point is, well, what do you want to do? Don't show anyone a box. Well, what I want to do is automate something. What I want to do is research something. What I want to do is make some images and so on. And I think that there is some middle ground of interfaces that sort of lurks in that area, or maybe something completely different than that I'm not thinking about. But what it isn't is an empty text box. It's not helpful, right? It's like someone says to you, right, you know, come up with a plot line for a romance novel right now. Go on, go. And you're going to be like, I don't know. And it's not, and you can't think like that, right? You need to have something that coaxes you in and handholds you to a degree. But we don't want to go fully to the other direction, which is, you know, here's prescription. You can only do these 10 things, right?
Yeah.
Which is exactly the sort of world that LLMs should take us away from, right? You know, we could only program it to do these 10 things, so that's all you've got. Or you want to do this thing a slightly different way. Well, you can't, because we didn't program it that way. Well, it hasn't completely made that problem go away, but it's certainly ameliorated for quite a few use cases.
Yeah, and you know, some of the examples they've got on their site, you know, have people you know, loading up historic documents and then enabling a team to, you know, reference stuff from the past. And so, like you say, rather than kind of like, well, here's a blank box, it's like, well, okay, let me load in 3 documents. So what would I do now? Well, I'd ask it a question on it, right? So immediately there's a really good way in there, you know. And I think they give some examples on the podcast. It just basically, it's kind of like putting a chatbot in front of your documents. And if you've got 10 of those, then rather than having just a document which you sort of got to read and reference and answer, you just ask a chatbot and it goes off and comes back with an answer. And that, it just seems like a great starting point, because straight away you can ask it a couple of questions. The answers you get are going to make you think of something to go, oh, that's interesting. And then that's it, you're off. You know, with the right sort of mindset, your interaction with that is going to be so much richer than, like you say, sort of blank box, well, what do I ask first, you know? So so I can really see this being useful. I mean, I'm going to give it a whirl. we had a bit more of a specific use case, but which is kind of worth mentioning, of essentially building several assistants with specific points of view about things. And we were thinking of like the, you know, the skeptic, the salesman, the practical person, and you put them in a room and you give them a subject to discuss or a proposal to run through. And then each person, you know, has a specific point of view about it. And we kind of wanted to step back and kind of go, okay, well, we need someone to orchestrate that. And they just need to have a chat, and then we'll look at the chat after it's happened, because it would help us analyze, you know, different points of view about things. So I'm not sure whether it's quite as advanced that I could use it for that orchestration. But you can see, especially if people, you know, in their daily jobs are going, well, actually, you know, I've got three or four different personas that I need. And then at some point it might want those to interact. So you could see this becoming, you know, it's a slightly human way to think about things. Well, I've got these three personas, they need to have a meeting.
So you've strayed into the realms of sort of things like virtual focus groups and virtual juries and stuff.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of fun we could have with that. And I actually think we should do that on a future episode in much more detail, because there's quite a lot of richness in terms of that conversation with regards to, you know, how that would work, that we've discussed at length before. I quite like the idea that you can also put in some quite, you know, quite extreme characters in there, and give them something really chewy to mull over and see if you get any arguments or actual fights, right?
Yeah.
And how would you do it? So, like, when people got into an argument, right, and then actually someone hit someone else or something in the, you know, just via the LLM, right? Like, you can just have, you know, instructed to say, if you get too annoyed with anyone, you are actually allowed to punch them. And it's, you know, comes up and says, person A punched person B, right? And then just see if it descends into a total brawl. And whether or not the LLM can use enough imagination to extrapolate that into like an episode of Reacher or something. So that's where we're going with this, obviously. Right. No, and I more seriously do think we really should come back and do virtual focus groups, but I think we should leave it there for today.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And go and experience the rest of our day. So good. We'll see everyone next time.
Yep. See you soon.
Bye.